When I was growing up, there were three films that I watched more than any other films in my life. My guess is I wouldn't even have to name them for you to be able to work out what these three films were. I was born in 1983, so I was in like a good spot for these films to still be being hyped up. And I remember sometimes in a week I'd watch the trilogy through twice. You know, I'd watch each of them twice. I hate to think how many hours of my life I have spent watching these films. And along with Cool Runnings and The Sound of Music, these were my favorite films growing up. So, you know, occasionally one of them would get knocked off top spot by Cool Runnings or The Sound of Music. But normally it was one of A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, or Return of the Jedi that I'd just keep going back to over and over and over again. I watched them loads. But then in 1997, so I'm 14. In 1997, George Lucas decided that he was going to make some new editions of these films with some extra scenes in because CGI had got so much better now. He could do things that he couldn't do at the time. So he's like, look, now that computer graphics are so much better, I can make the films I always wanted to make. And so he remade them with extra scenes in them. If you watch them now, that's probably the version you are watching. You're probably not watching the original films that came out. You're probably watching the 1997 remakes with the additional scenes in. Now, as you can imagine, a 14-year-old me was excited by the prospect of this. And I went to the cinema to see them. I bought them when they came out on VHS. For those of you who don't know what that is, then look it up. And I was really excited about these. But George Lucas was the only person in the world who thought that what these films were really lacking was more CGI singing Muppets. Like, that was what he really thought the films were lacking. If you ever watch them, basically what he's added is 10 minutes of like musical, computer-generated, like Muppets singing and playing a musical instrument. That's what he's added to those films. But there is one thing he added. At the end of A New Hope, and I think maybe Return of the Jedi, you have this moment where the good guys win and they blow up the Death Star. If you've never seen Star Wars, I can't give you the whole backstory. You're just gonna have to go with me. But if you've never seen Star Wars, what have you been doing with the last like however long of your life? But anyway, so the Death Star blows up, the good guys win. And in the original films, that was basically the end. You had like a medal ceremony, but basically the end. But what he added in was he added in these shots where you go around different planets and you see them reacting to the victory of good over evil. You see, a planet of Wookiees cheering and a planet of Ewoks celebrating and Coruscant doing whatever Coruscant does. And you just go around, and you get all these snapshots of how different people are responding to what has just happened, to this great victory of good over evil. And it strikes me that as we come into Mark 6, that's kind of what we have going on here in Mark 6. You see, we've just had, if you've been with us the last few weeks, you've heard this, we've just had Jesus, some accounts of Jesus doing incredible things. You know, we've just had the story of Jesus' victory over the forces of evil. You know, we've had him calming storms and casting out demons and healing the sick and even raising the dead. These unbelievable signs of power and the victory of good over evil, the victory of life over death, the thing that we as human beings longed for has been happening in Mark so far. But come to chapter 6, and the scene kind of changes. Because now what we're going to do is we're going to have some like snapshots into what is everyone making of this? You know, maybe it never crossed your mind, but in first century Israel, what's everyone doing when they're hearing these stories of Jesus going, did you hear what Jesus did? Did you hear what Jesus did yesterday? He calmed the storm. I heard he calmed the storm. Some people told me, I can't be. Like, what were they making of it? Like, what was everyone making of it? So what we're going to have here is we're going to have the camera like panning around. We're going to go to Jesus' hometown and see what they make of it. We're going to go to the palace and see what the rulers and kings of the time make of it. We're going to go around some villages and see what they make of it. We're going to start seeing what people are making of all that Jesus has been doing. What does the average person on the street think of what's been going on? Because you see, these stories that we've been looking at, these stories about Jesus' life, they're amazing stories. This is why, you know, you have like kids' Bibles, and people who aren't Christians will look at them and read them and enjoy reading them because they're incredible stories. What Jesus did throughout that we read in Mark's Gospel, what Jesus did is the greatest thing that's ever been done in all of history. Now, not just, you know, for me as a Christian, for us in Western civilization, it's the most significant thing that's happened. But what really matters, and what I want you to think about this afternoon, is how do you react to these stories? Like, what do you actually do with them? As we read them, as we think about them, as we talk about them, what are you going to do about them? Because that's actually what really matters. If we leave them as sort of entertaining stories, you know, just kind of stories you read in kids' Bibles, you grow up knowing, maybe you go to Sunday school, you learn about. We can leave them behind once you grow up into adulthood, because they're just fun stories for kids. If you leave them as that, they're not really going to have much impact on your life. You're not going to be changed by that. Similarly, if you think of them as kind of things that didn't really happen, you know, you don't believe that they happen, you believe they have no significance, then you're not really going to do anything as a result of that. And this is true not just of these stories, but of every story and every piece of information you ever come across. So if you watch an Attenborough and you watch him kind of telling the story of like little Toto the lion or whoever it is, and you watch him going around, he often ends with that kind of slight doom scrolling bit about the end of the world and, you know, ice caps melting and all that sort of stuff, and how, you know, all these creatures' habitats are dying out. Now, when you watch that documentary, I enjoy those documentaries, I've watched many of them, but when you watch those, first you have to decide, do I believe what he's telling me about what's going on in the world, and do I believe that what he's saying is causing it is true? You first got to decide, do you believe it? And some people will decide one way, some people will decide another, but that's the first thing you've got to decide. And then you've got to decide, if I believe it, what does it mean? Like, what's the significance of it? Like what is going to happen as a result of this? Why does this story matter? And then you've got to decide, what, if anything, am I going to do as a result of having watched this or heard this? Like, they're the three things you've got to decide. Am I going to do anything different as a result of this? Now, that's true of an atom, but it's true of everything. It's true of a conversation you have with your friends where someone says, oh, did you hear what they did the other day? You first got to decide, do I believe it? Then you've got to say, and what does it mean? And then you've got to decide, do I need to do anything on the basis of it? Every piece of information you get, you're doing the same things with. You're deciding whether you believe it. You're working out what it means, and then he's trying to go, do I need to do anything on the basis of it? And that's really what I want us to be doing with these stories of Jesus' life. I want us to be thinking about them and going, okay, do I believe it happened? If I do, what does it mean? What's the significance of it? And, crucially, this last bit, do I need to do anything as a result of it? As a church, we don't open up the Bible. We don't look at these stories simply to entertain you. But that's not what we're doing here. I'm not here primarily to entertain you. We're here to help you understand more of who the person of Jesus is, so that you can think about, well, what does that mean? And so you can then respond appropriately, work out what it is you need to do about it. That's our hope, that's our prayer, that's our goal as we look at these stories together. So, if that's our goal, let's get into it. And let's see how people at the time responded to Jesus. So, Mark 6, page 1008. I'm just going to read the first 5.5 verses. Or is it? Yeah, 5.5 verses. Let me read it. Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue. And many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things, they asked. What's this wisdom that has been given him? What are these remarkable miracles he's performing? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own town, among his relatives and in his own home. He could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few people who were ill and heal them. He was amazed at their lack of faith. So, Imagine the scene at the end of A New Hope. The girl's been raised, the camera flashes away from Jesus raising the girl, and we're in Jesus' hometown. And Jesus is there, he's doing a homecoming tour. And he's turning up. And he does what he always does. He does the usual thing. He goes down to the local synagogue on a Saturday and he begins to teach. And people are amazed. They hear it and they go, I've never heard anything like this. It's got all the makings of a real, like, local lad come good kind of story, you know? This guy from this place, Nazareth, tiny place, probably 500 people, of no significance, has made a big splash out there in the world, and he's come back to his hometown as, like, a local hero. But the thing that confuses them is, where did Jesus get this wisdom, this insight from? Because they saw him grow up, and he didn't get it. You know, they went to the same schools and they mixed with the same people. And they saw him start his profession as a carpenter. He wasn't anything, you know, he didn't go through theology school or he didn't do anything like that. He grew up as a carpenter. They knew, they'd seen him grow up, just ordinary guy. They knew his family from a normal kind of family. Nothing exceptional about his family. They knew his brothers, they knew his sisters. And all of a sudden, there starts to be this muttering around the synagogue. Who does Jesus think he is telling us what we should think? Who does Jesus think that he is that he can come here and teach in our synagogue on a Saturday? He hasn't had any of the training. Maybe there's that kind of hint of, oh, he thinks he's such a big deal, doesn't he, that Jesus guy? You know, he's gone out, he's done a few things, everyone's got really excited. He's come back here on his high horse feeling so good about himself. And suddenly the scene starts to turn a bit ugly. You know, it's hardly the, like, open bus tour as he tours around his home village. It's not that they don't think, the teaching's amazing. They do, they say it's amazing. And it's not that they don't think the miracles are remarkable, because they do, they say these miracles are remarkable. In fact, that's the thing that annoys them. What annoys them is how amazing the teaching is and how remarkable the miracles is, considering who it is who's doing it. They just can't accept the idea that they should pay attention to someone who's basically just like them. I want to suggest that this kind of response helpfully warns us against three reactions all of us might be in danger of having to the person of Jesus. The first is that desire that I think probably lurks in all of us, and we see in the world all around us, to discredit people. It seems to me that as a culture, we often love a scandal. You know, we love it when the guy who's been riding the crest of a wave, we love it when it crashes, when he fails. We love to tear people down a peg or two. And I think part of the appeal of that is it makes us feel better about ourselves. You know, if I can look at that person and go, yeah, but look, they're not that good anyway. Look at how they failed. It makes us feel better about all the ways that we failed. About all the ways that we failed to be the people we want to be. So it makes us feel better about ourselves. But then the second reason we like to discredit people is because it gives us an excuse not to listen to them. It's a perfect excuse not to listen to someone. If we can label someone as, let me give you some popular options, a misogynist, a racist, a liar, too old, a little bit crazy, then we can ignore everything they say, regardless of whether it's good or not. Because we've written them off. We've just gone, they are this thing, and therefore we don't have to listen to them. We're no longer judging them based on what they actually say. It doesn't matter whether what they say is good or bad anymore, because we have decided this person is this thing, and I don't have to listen to them. We know that Jesus' teaching was incredibly challenging. It was about forgiveness and love and sin and judgment and our need for repentance and faith. And maybe people heard it, and maybe they were just challenged by it. Maybe when they heard it, they couldn't just ignore it very easily. They thought, that kind of makes sense. And it talks about how I feel about myself. It resonates with me. It connects with how I experience the world. And it started to make sense to them. Maybe they even knew they should really do something about it. But they just didn't want to. They didn't want to have to change their life. They didn't want to have to be challenged. They didn't want to have to do anything different. And so they go, wait a minute. If we just discredit him, if we just go, who is this Jesus to tell me what to do? We saw him grow up. What does he know anyway? He's only a carpenter. Then they can convince themselves they don't really need to do anything about what Jesus is saying. If you are sat here today and you don't want to listen to Jesus, you don't actually want to hear what he says, you don't want to be challenged by him, you don't want to be changed by him, the easiest way to do that is to discredit him. Find a reason why you can ignore him. There's many out there. He didn't really exist. Great, I can now ignore him. He probably didn't even say these things. Great, now I can ignore him. He was a product of his time, so I can ignore him. It doesn't apply to me now in the situation I'm going through, so I can ignore him. He contradicts himself, so I can ignore him. Like, whatever it is, we find the reason, and we push him to the side, and we ignore him. And I just want to encourage you not to do that. Don't find that reason not to listen to him. Don't allow your preconceptions and prejudices to get in the way of actually engaging with the things he says and does. At least give him a hearing. At least hear what he actually says. See what he actually does. So that's the first one. It's that warning against that desire we have to discredit people so that we can ignore them, and how we can apply that into Jesus and into what he's saying. Here's the second warning, and it's a warning against the kind of familiarity. That's why Jesus says, you know, nowhere is a prophet without honor except in his hometown. Because in his hometown, everyone's so familiar with him. They're like, we know who Jesus is. We saw him grow up. We know what he's like. We know the kind of things he says. We know what he can and can't do. I don't know if you've ever had that. I have it a little bit, because there's some people, even in this church, who knew me when I grew up. And it's quite hard to shake people's ideas of what you were like. You know, for them, how I was when I'm 13 is still how I am when I'm 41, because it's quite hard to shake the things people have decided about you. Ben is like this, and they just believe that now for the next 25 years, regardless of whether I'm still like that or not. Now, that's true of all of us. You'll have had that experience of other people with you. You'll probably have done it to other people yourself. That's kind of what's going on here. And it got me thinking, what's the equivalent of Jesus' hometown today? Where might people be in danger of being overly familiar with the person of Jesus? You know, thinking, I've got him sussed. I know what he's like. I know the kind of things he's going to do. I mean, maybe it's the church. Maybe the church is the equivalent of Jesus' hometown, the place where people come and think, oh, we know what Jesus is like. We know exactly the things that Jesus would say. We know exactly how Jesus would behave. We know the kind of person he is. And maybe we allow that familiarity to stop us from being shocked by him, to prevent us from being challenged by him, to prevent us from actually engaging with the things he says. We've got to be careful we don't become so familiar with Jesus that we start fitting everything he does into our own view of what he was like. Jesus is often surprising and shocking. But often it doesn't feel that way to us. So we just fit him in to the way we always think about him. And so that's the second thing. So there's a warning against that desire just to discredit people so we don't have to listen to them. There's a warning against an over-familiarity that just goes, we know what Jesus is like and we can never change that. He can never be challenged by the things he actually does and says. And here's the final one, which probably underpins all of them. Maybe it's not even a different one, I don't know. But I think it's to be defensive because we feel threatened by Jesus. What he says makes us feel uncomfortable. It challenges and rebukes us. It suggests we haven't got everything right. And we like being right. And we like being in charge of our own lives. So we instantly become defensive. We don't like Jesus poking his nose in. We want to be left alone to live our own life our own way. Perhaps the most common way you experience this is when somebody challenges you about something you're doing or saying or the way you're living, and they say, well, you know, is this kind of the kind of life Jesus wants to live? And we instantly get on a high horse about that. We hate that. I mean, what do you know about these things? It's very easy to be instantly defensive about those things. When faced with the person of Jesus, it's easy to become just hostile to it, to be quick to justify why what we think is right. and slow to accept that Jesus might have any wisdom to offer into that situation. Here's just three warnings about how you might react to the person of Jesus. You might just seek to discredit him. You might become overly familiar so he can never shock you or change you or do anything in your life anymore. Or you might just become really defensive. So sure that you are right, that you're unwilling to even engage with it. You see, as Jesus goes about his work, the scenes are not quite the same scenes as you get at the end of A New Hope. They're not universally scenes of celebration. Not everyone is thrilled by what Jesus is doing. Instead, you see scenes of confusion, defensiveness, and opposition. But as that scene ends, so imagine we're flashing away from a little snapshot into the hometown, and now we're going to go somewhere else. If you'll allow me to skip a few verses for cinematic reasons, we're going to skip to Herod. I'm going to come back to the verse in the middle, but I'm going to skip to the palace. Okay, so if you've got a Bible open in front of you, this is the bit that begins verse 14 and goes down to 29. Now let me read it for you. King Herod heard about this. This is everything Jesus has been doing. And for Jesus' name had become well known. Some were saying, John the Baptist has been raised from the dead, and this is why miraculous powers are at work in him. Others said, he's Elijah. Still others claimed, he's a prophet, like one of the prophets of long ago. But when Herod heard this, he said, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised from the dead. For Herod himself had given orders to have John arrested, and he had had him bound and put in prison. He did this because of Herodias, his brother's wife, whom he had married. For John had been saying to Herod, it's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. So Herodias nursed a grudge against John and wanted to kill him. But she was not able to, because Herod feared John and protected him, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man. When Herod heard John, he was greatly puzzled, yet he liked to listen to him. Finally, the opportune time came. On his birthday, Herod gave a banquet for his high officials and military commanders and the leading men of Galilee. When the daughter of Herodias came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his dinner guests. The king said to the girl, ask me for anything you want and I'll give it to you. And he promised her with an oath, whatever you ask, I will give you up to half my kingdom. She went out and said to her mother, what shall I ask for? The head of John the Baptist, she answered. At once the girl hurried into the king with the request, I want you to give me right now the head of John the Baptist on a platter. The king was greatly distressed, but because of his oaths and his dinner guests, he did not want to refuse her. So he immediately sent an executioner with an order to bring John's head. The man went, beheaded John in prison, and brought back his head on a platter. He presented it to the girl, and she gave it to her mother. On hearing of this, John's disciples came and took his body and laid it in a tomb. The scene starts with Herod hearing about Jesus. As he hears these stories of this person who's been going around doing amazing things, teaching and healing and doing these miracles, it reminds him of John the Baptist. You can read about him at the start of Mark's Gospel. He was a guy who came before Jesus, prepared the way for him. And it reminds him of that. And Herod becomes convinced that Jesus must be John the Baptist come back to life, because he's doing similar kind of things, talking about similar sort of ideas. And so then you get a flashback scene to the moment where Herod had John killed. It was a party a few months previous, a party where there's food and dancing and all kind of laddishness. As a young woman dances for them, Herod makes a foolish promise and it results in the beheading of John. And maybe it's guilt about that. Maybe it's fear about the kind of things that John said. But it convinces John that this person, this Jesus, must be the same person. But what we see in this palace is another way of reacting to Jesus, to God's work, and to everything that's going on there. Because you see, Herod's behavior is actually impacted by a whole load of factors that are external to him. Some of it's internal, some of it's external, there's a mix of things going on. So partly he's impacted by his feelings, very feelings driven. The woman dances, he gets carried away in a desire to impress, makes a foolish promise. And what does that promise do? It sets him up against God. That's crucially what it's doing. He's setting himself up against God and all that he is doing through the person of John, the person of Jesus. So he's impacted by his own feelings. He's also impacted by his own sin, right? So he doesn't like the fact that John has been calling him out, that saying that he shouldn't have married his brother's wife. Seems a perfectly reasonable thing to say, in my opinion. But Herod's not keen on this. He doesn't like someone out there giving everyone the impression that he's done something wrong. You almost get the impression that he knew it was wrong, but was unwilling to turn away from it. So he couldn't tolerate John repeatedly just telling everyone, look, what Hemp's doing is wrong. So he's impacted by his feelings, he's impacted by his sin. But crucially, when it comes to it at the end, he's impacted by the crowd. He's so driven by the people around him. Peer pressure and pride are at the forefront of everything that happens here. He arrests John because of his pride. He makes a foolish promise in an attempt to show off in front of his high officials. And then in the end, he kills John simply because he doesn't want to lose face. He doesn't want to admit, oh, that was maybe a stupid promise I shouldn't have made. I just want you to be aware, how you are responding to Jesus right now, whatever you're making as you hear these stories about Jesus, there's a whole load of factors playing into that. It's not just an internal battle. It's not just about our own defensiveness and pride. It's also our behaviours. You see, we find sin alluring. And so we find it hard to accept what Jesus says about it. We just want that relationship, that behaviour, that attitude, that lifestyle so much. And even if we know it's bad for us, even if we know it's inappropriate and harmful, our feelings get the better of us and we choose it ahead of Jesus every time. See, how you're responding to Jesus isn't just about what you think about him and what you make about him. It's based on how you feel about the things that you're doing in your life. But it's also based on the environment that you find yourself in. What you make of Jesus is heavily influenced by what the people around you are saying and doing. Everyone, or lots of people around us, can be hostile to Jesus. And it's easy for us to worry, what will they think of us? We don't want to be seen as weak or boring or weird or whatever it is. You see, we all like to think, oh, the way I think about Jesus, the way I behave in my life is entirely rational. I just think about things and then I make very rational decisions. When the reality is that our reactions are often more influenced by our feelings and our environment than they are by our minds. Herod comes across as impulsive, easily influenced and weak. And interestingly, that's sufficient to extinguish the curiosity he clearly has about God. That's the tragedy of Herod's story. He finds what John says interesting. He likes to listen to him. There's something there. There's a bit of interest. There's a spark of life. But he just gets crushed by the lifestyle he wants to live and by the pressure of the people around him. You see, how we react to Jesus is complicated. It's constantly being influenced by sin. Our pride makes us defensive. Our feelings at times make us hostile. Those around us influence us more than we would like to accept. So rather than hearing what Jesus has to say and responding appropriately, we either refuse to hear it or refuse to change. And the risk is that, like Herod, that little spark of new life, that something different that could grow in your life, just gets snuffed out. Never comes about. You see, you've got these two scenes. Jesus out there doing this amazing stuff, but in the palace, people aren't really down with it. And in his hometown, people aren't really getting on with it either. But in the middle, there is some good news. Because now we're going to go around some villages and we're going to see a very different scene. Let me read it to you. It's verses, the second half of 6 down to verse 13. Then Jesus went around teaching from village to village. And calling the 12 to him, he began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over impure spirits. These were his instructions. Take nothing for the journey except a staff. No bed, no bag, no money in your belt. Wear sandals, but not an extra shirt. Whenever you enter a house, stay there until you leave that town. And if any place will not welcome you or listen to you, leave that place and shake the dust off your feet as a testimony against them. They went out and preached that people should repent. They drove out many demons and anointed with oil many people who were ill and healed them. You see, there's a different scene here. You've got these disciples and they're going out village to village. And as they go out, they're continuing Jesus' work. They're doing what he was doing. I mean, the similarities are so clearly pointed out for us. Just as Jesus had been preaching that people need to repent, now they're going out preaching that people need to repent. Just as Jesus was seen driving out demons and healing people. We've literally just seen in chapter 5. So they, his followers, go out and do the same. That's the response that Jesus is looking for. What's the right reaction to Jesus? What's the right response to the person Jesus you see what he's doing? It's to get involved with what he's doing. It's not skepticism or fear or hostility, but rather faith and involvement. I just want you to notice here, because I think it's a mistake it's really easy to make. The correct response is not simply receiving. The appropriate response to Jesus is not simply believing it for yourself, repenting yourself, and coming to know him yourself. That's part of the right response, don't get me wrong. It's a pretty important first step as well. But the correct response is to get involved with what he is doing. Jesus' vision for your life is not simply that you will find forgiveness and life and joy, but that having found those things, you would be part of his mission of bringing those things to other people. That's Jesus' mission for your life. That's what he wants you to be doing. I sometimes wonder if our Christianity, specifically in 21st century Hartlepool, I sometimes wonder if it's become a bit uninspiring, become a bit like flat, a little bit mundane, not very exciting. And I wonder if that happens because we're not doing what the disciples did here. We don't throw ourselves into the work which Jesus is doing and is calling us to be a part of. If our Christianity is simply about what we receive, we lack an outward focus. We lack a purpose. We lack a drive. Put as soon as we can, we lack a reason to get out of bed in the morning. But if the life that Jesus brings us is a life that we don't simply receive, but we also, crucially, get to live. That's what a life is. It's a thing that you live. Well, then, I think Christianity becomes this exciting, meaningful way of life. If you've been with us in Mark so far, you might get to this bit, and you might find it surprising. I certainly did, that Jesus is sending out the disciples here. I mean, the disciples don't even seem to understand who Jesus is yet. I mean, they're in a boat when he calmed the storm and were terrified of him. They're constantly confused by everything he does. They don't seem to have any concept, really, of who he is yet. So what's Jesus doing sending them out to these villagers? They don't know anything. You know, I'd be terrified. I'd be like, what are they going to say? They could say anything. And yet Jesus just sends them out. These clueless disciples, often obstructive to Jesus, getting in the way of what he's doing, and he sends them out by themselves. Why would Jesus do that? Well, isn't that the encouragement for any of us who want to be involved in this kind of life? Isn't that the greatest encouragement we could have? Jesus doesn't need us to be sorted to start getting involved. He doesn't need us to understand everything or to be the finished product. He simply needs us to know him, to depend on him, and he will equip us for the world. I mean, that's almost, if there's one central idea in these verses, it's clearly that they need to be dependent on Jesus. Like, that's why he keeps saying to them, don't take this, don't take that, don't take these. He gives them a long list of things not to take. It's like a weird set of instructions. Like, when you're just about to send people out and they're horribly unqualified, if I was doing that training session, I would be like, right, I've come with a list of 10 things for you not to take. Like, that would be the least useful training I could give people for that mission. And yet, that's what Jesus does here. He says, here are all the things you shouldn't take. Why is he doing that? Clearly, because the only qualification they need to be involved in what Jesus is doing is dependence on him. Is to know that they can't do it themselves. The work is not easy. There's a reason why this section in Mark's Gospel comes in between loads of people being offended by what Jesus says and the greatest prophet that's ever lived having his head chopped off. There's a reason why this comes in the middle. It's because it's not easy. And it particularly wasn't easy for the early church. Sometimes people will be offended as we seek to do Jesus' work. Sometimes people will be hostile. The work is not easy. But when you know the forgiveness Jesus gives us, when you see the healing he offers, when you experience the freedom he brings, I think think it becomes increasingly clear that there could be no better thing to devote your life to than getting involved with sharing that forgiveness, that healing, that freedom with others. Imagine if you could devote your life to helping people find forgiveness, to helping people find joy, to helping people find purpose, to helping people find freedom, to helping people find the God who made them and who they long for deep in their being. Imagine if you could devote your life to that. Wouldn't that be something worthwhile? Wouldn't that be a life worth living? If you're not a Christian here today, if you're maybe at a time in the past you'd call yourself a Christian, but now you're not that fussed about it, or maybe you've never got there, I just want to say that's what we want for you. We want you to know Jesus and to get involved with what he's doing. It's not simply an invitation to receive something. It's an invitation to be a part of something, to be a part of what Jesus is doing. And if you are a Christian here today, if you're somebody who knows Jesus, who follows him, our invitation to Grace Church really is straightforward. Get involved. Not just with Grace Church. Get involved with what Jesus is doing. Get involved with what he's doing, sharing that good news. I want you to know it for yourself. I want you to experience his forgiveness and his joy and his life and all those things. But then I want you to use that to prompt you to get involved with that work of sharing that with other people. That's what Jesus does straight away with these disciples here. Nowhere near as qualified as most of us in this room for it. But they know Jesus and they're willing to depend on him. And so out they go. Let me pray for you, and then we're going to respond.